Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups for the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host a webinar, Does One Size Fit All? Qualified Immunity Inside and Outside Split-Second Policing Decisions, featuring Elliot Averett and William Most. Our moderator today is Aya Bidwell. Aya leads the Institute for Justice's Project on Immunity and Accountability and serves as an advisor on the American Law Institute's Restatement of the Law Constitutional Torts Project. She appeared several times before the Supreme Court, most recently successfully arguing Gonzalez v. Trevino. Before joining IJ, she worked for a top national law firm, handling cases in trial and appellate courts, and she earned her JD with honors from the University of Texas. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, thank you all for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Hi, everyone. Thank you to FedSoc for hosting this discussion. Thank you to the audience for coming to this webinar on qualified immunity. I'm assuming you all are FedCourts nerds, or at least aficionados, so let's jump right in. As you all know, at the heart of qualified immunity is the principle that an official must have fair warning that his actions would violate constitutional rights. In Mullinex versus Luna, the Supreme Court stated that such a fair warning should not be provided at a high level of generality. Instead, the dispositive question is whether the violative nature of a particular conduct is clearly established. The court then emphasized that this level of specificity in precedent is, quote, especially important in the Fourth Amendment context, end quote, because it is hard for an officer to determine how a relevant legal doctrine like excessive force applies to the factual situation the officer confronts. Some circuits, like the Fifth, take it to mean that split-second decision-making by police is a special area of the qualified immunity jurisprudence, that when it comes to excessive force claims against police officers, plaintiffs cannot overcome qualified immunity unless they point to a case with materially identical facts. As Judge Oldham explained in Morrow versus Meacham, quote, in the typical excessive force case, the law must be so clearly established that in the blink of an eye, in the middle of a high-speed chase, every reasonable officer would know it immediately, end quote. Outside of split-second decision-making by police, on the other hand, the trend in some circuits has been to allow plaintiffs more breathing room when looking for a precedent clearly establishing the law. As the 11th Circuit reaffirmed just last week, plaintiffs, even in circumstances involving novel facts, can still overcome qualified immunity if they point to a broader, clearly established principle that's derived from general statements of the law, or if the constitutional violation is obvious. So, how should we think about qualified immunity in light of these statements? Is it a bifurcated doctrine in that split-second decision-making by police gets a special carve-out and other defendants, like, say, university administrators or mayors, can be sued more easily? Or does this tailored approach miss the mark in that we already account for time pressures when we look at the elements of the Fourth Amendment, like the reasonableness of using force, before we even get to the question of whether the law was clearly established? For those advocating against qualified immunity, does it make sense to try to cordon off excessive force cases and fight for an easier test outside of this area of the law? And even if it makes sense to have a tailored approach, Should it be judicial branch implementing it, or should it be something that legislators are better positioned to do? We'll explore these questions and more with our two guests, William Most and Elliot Averett. William Most practices civil rights law at Most & Associates, a litigation boutique he founded in New Orleans, Louisiana. He handles a wide range of legal issues, from police misconduct to prisoner overdetention, to abuse of children in public schools, to violations of landowner rights and voting rights. As you might expect, William's been battling various immunities as a part of his legal practice, and he's seen it apply to all kinds of government officials, from police officers to directors of prisons to school administrators and the like. William just won the Federal Bar Association New Orleans Chapter Public Service Award. Congratulations, William, and welcome.
Thank you very much. So I really appreciate this.
Hold on, William. Let me introduce Elliot and then I'll let you get going. So Elliot Averett is a lawyer with Brian Cave Leighton Paisner. He has experience in a wide variety of litigation, from criminal matters to class actions to commercial disputes. Elliot published a law review article about qualified immunity in the Georgetown Journal of Law and Public Policy titled "An Unqualified Defense of Qualified Immunity." Before law school, Elliot followed in his mom's footsteps and served as a police officer in Seattle, Washington. Welcome to you, Elliot, too. I am Anya Bidwell. I'm a lawyer with the Institute for Justice, as you've heard. Full disclosure, I fight qualified immunity on a daily basis. But as a moderator of this conversation, I will leave my personal views at the door. And so with that, let's get going. William and Elliot will each speak for about 10 minutes. We will then do a bit of a back and forth and then open it up for questions from the audience. Please use the Zoom link question function to send questions our way. So let's get going, William.
Thank you. So just jumping into it, I think it helps when we're talking about qualified immunity, and particularly should it be tailored for certain circumstances or not, to take a step back and say, like, what is it and where did it come from? So that then we can figure out whether it should be gotten rid of completely, tailored for certain circumstances, or just left alone. So qualified immunity, I think a great place to start, this case sticks in my head all the time, which is Jessup v. City of Fresno. This is a 2019 Ninth Circuit case where officers were accused of just, during a search, stealing $225,000 in cash and rare coins from someone whose house they searched. That seems pretty obviously illegal for officers to just take your money. But the Ninth Circuit held that qualified immunity barred that lawsuit on the theory that because the Ninth Circuit had never previously said it's illegal to steal people's gold coins during a search or cash, then these officers can't be held personally accountable for it. And so when you have a doctrine, a legal doctrine that stops us from holding officers accountable when they just straight up take our money out of our house, I think we have a problem. Right? This is a problematic doctrine if that's what it does. So going back to what is it? It's qualified immunity is a doctrine that has an analysis with two steps. The first step is, was a constitutional right violated? And that one is pretty unobjectionable. That's just our standard constitutional analysis. Did the officer break the Fourth Amendment, the 14th Amendment, whatever? The second part is the part that's problematic. It's the in order to hold an officer liable for damages in a civil suit, you have to not only show that they violated the Constitution, but also that that violation or that right was clearly established before the officer took that action, which sounds kind of benign, but when you think about it, that's not a protection that most people get in court. If you or I are sued for breaking the law, we don't get to say, well, yeah, I broke the law, but no court had decided that exactly what I did broke the law before I did it, right? You and I don't get that defense, but officers of all stripes can invoke it. And I think this is something Anya pointed out, which is we think often about qualified immunity, thinking like in our head, we imagine a police officer on the street, But that's not just who invokes it. All sorts of government officials can invoke it. So these are real cases. The Fifth Circuit recently addressed a case in which a school principal had invoked qualified immunity when he was accused of letting a teacher sexually abuse a student. Prison administrators who keep inmates in prison past the end of their sentence invoke qualified immunity. This is a real case that I handled. A sheriff who asked a lawyer, can I arrest this person who's criticizing me? And the lawyer said, no, you can't. The sheriff arrested him anyway. That sheriff invoked qualified immunity as well. And I saw in the Q&A, there was a question of, could a nonprofit charter school board member invoke qualified immunity? And I think plausibly so. I mean, charter schools can be sued for constitutional violations. And so I would expect that some of their officials might invoke qualified immunity if they did get sued for a constitutional violation. So this is, I think, the best 50 seconds about qualified immunity and why it's kind of absurd. So I'm just going to play it. Let me know if you can't hear yourself.
Why did you do that?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. It's just, I thought you were going to slap me first.
Okay, well, I feel like you should still get in trouble.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, we can get the teacher in here.
Is there a problem here?
Yeah, he slapped me. He should get in trouble, right?
Has he slapped people before?
Yeah.
And did he get in trouble then?
No.
Okay, so according to the rules, he can't get in trouble now.
Wait, what? That doesn't...
Did you see that? He just slapped me again.
Has he done this before?
Yeah, like, it literally just happened.
And did he get in trouble then?
No.
Okay, so according to the rules, he can't get in trouble now.
Wait, I'm sorry, what kind of rule? This can't be legal.
It is.
It is, yeah.
Can I slap him?
No, he's special. You would go to jail.
That's how qualified immunity works, plays out in courts, right? This is funny, right? But this is legally accurate. Because the Supreme Court has said that if you, a court, decides like there hasn't been a prior case on this, you don't even need to decide the constitutionality of what's in front of you. And so what happens is the law sort of doesn't progress because courts keep skipping over the question of whether an officer broke the Constitution in the case in front of them. So this is, and I would challenge my colleague Elliot, look, if there's anything inaccurate in this TikTok, I'd love to hear it because I think it's an accurate depiction of qualified immunity litigation.
Hey.
So qualified immunity, where does it come from? It's not in a statute, right? It's not in the text of the statute that it applies to. So the statute that usually is involved is 42 U.S.C. 1983, which was part of the Ku Klux Klan Act shortly after the Civil War to hold people liable when they violate the Constitution. Qualified immunity is not in the text of the statute. Where it comes from is some Supreme Court cases from the late 1900s, which looked at Section 1983. And the Supreme Court said, well, Section 1983 doesn't say anything about common law immunities. So we assume that Congress meant to silently incorporate common law immunities when they wrote this statute. I don't know about that as a conclusion, but recent scholarship, actually some lawyers at the Institute for Justice and then some law professors have figured something out, which is totally nuts, which is, this whole thing that the statute was silent about common law immunities is wrong. So if you actually go back to the original text, the Act of Congress, there is a clause that's in the original act that says that officers shall be liable any such law, statute, ordinance, regulation, custom, or usage of the state to the contrary, notwithstanding. So Congress really said, look, if you got background principles of immunity, we're going to throw them out. We're going to hold people liable when they violate the Constitution. The problem is later on, this got condensed when it was put into the U.S. Code, and this section got taken out because it was superfluous. But this original act still has the force of law. And look, you don't have to take my word for it that this is a big deal. Trump appointee Judge Willett on the Fifth Circuit said this whole thing about like finding the original text is a game-changing argument. He says, the doctrine of qualified immunity does not merely complement the text, it brazenly contradicts the text of the statute. So it's not textual, qualified immunity. Is it historical? It's not. Justice Thomas has said that if you go back and look at treatises and case law, you can't find anything from the 1800s or early 1900s that provides support for this clearly established law test. And he points out that Supreme Court didn't adopt qualified immunity because of general principles of tort immunities. They did it because they balanced competing values about litigation costs and efficiency. It was a policy choice, not a textual or historical choice. But I don't even think it's good policy. So, you know, something that's brought up a lot is, you know, we need qualified immunity so that we don't put officers into bankruptcy. But officers don't pay judgments. One study showed that they only paid 0.02% of the dollars that were actually awarded in police misconduct cases. They don't pay any of the punitives. So it's not about ending weak cases, because very few cases are entirely thrown out by qualified immunity. So professors who study this have shown that qualified immunity isn't even meeting the policy goals that its proponents think support it. So look, my take is we pay government officials salary, we pay their legal fees, they work for us, the government works for us. So they should be held to a higher standard, not a dramatically lower standard where they're protected from their accountability for their actions. So it's an atextual doctrine that's ahistorical, fails to meet its own policy goals, makes litigation slower and more expensive, and stops you from suing the government when they steal your money. So that's a problem. So then should it be tailored for non-split second scenarios? I don't think it has to, or really should or makes sense to, because when we are talking about use of force, the Fourth Amendment already asks, was it reasonable for this officer to use force in the way they did? And so the split secondness of actions on the street, which look, I acknowledge, it can be tough to make split second decisions, but that already can be factored into the reasonableness inquiry of the constitutional violation. We don't need this extra clearly established thing because it just doesn't reflect reality. Officers, and maybe Elliot can correct me if I'm wrong, in a split second scenario about deciding whether to shoot or not, I don't think officers are thinking back through case law and deciding, you know, would this action be clearly established by the circuit court precedent in the state where I live. I do think, however, and this is something I've been tracking, that judges are tailoring qualified immunity for non-split second scenarios. So there's been a series of cases I've been tracking the Fifth Circuit where when it's a slow moving scenario, like maybe our sheriff we talked about who went and talked to a lawyer who did some research and then made a choice to arrest someone, it does seem like judges are sort of blunting the impact of qualified immunity a little bit in those scenarios while still sort of maintaining it full strength in split second scenarios. So I think it's accurate to describe judges as sort of doing that. Whether or not they really should, I mean, I think the simpler solution is just get rid of this doctrine entirely and then incorporate all the sort of reasons why you might not want to second guess an officer's decision making in a split second scenario. Just incorporate that into the reasonableness inquiry that's within the Fourth Amendment. So that's my take. I think that was about 10 minutes.
No, this is good.
Thanks, William. Well, thank you, Anya, for the introduction. And I guess a couple of caveats. I'm kind of speaking my own opinion here, not necessarily my firm or any employer. So with that said, you know, I guess I'll try and get into some of William's points, and I don't have a PowerPoint, so I apologize. But I'll try to get into some of William's points and then move on to sort of the conversation starter. I think when we're talking about cases like Jessup, it's a little bit misleading to say that Jessup means there's no accountability for the officers in that case. Obviously, you know, and to go back to sort of what qualified immunity is, qualified immunity is not an immunity from criminal prosecution. It's not an immunity from employment discipline. It's not an immunity from tort liability in state court. It's an immunity from liability brought for constitutional violations under Section 1983. So I think it's misleading to say that cases like Jessup totally deprive the plaintiffs of accountability. And, you know, to go back to an example William discussed, you know, in a case where a school official is failing to protect students from sexual abuse by a teacher, that's going to be, at least in California, massive civil tort liability in state court, whether there's a cause of action under Section 1983 or not. And so I think it's, and of course, in a case where an officer is engaging in criminal wrongdoing, prosecutors can and should prosecute them. And of course, employers can and will discipline them. And there's, you know, general trend over the last 10 to 15 years has been that there is much more accountability at the employment level, statewide certification boards that can impose disciplines, body cameras, so on and so forth. And I acknowledge, you know, I worked as a police officer in the Ninth Circuit. William is working as a plaintiff civil rights attorney in the Fifth Circuit. Those are going to be different worlds, right, in a lot of ways, just because of the ways that the law comes out in these two different circuits. You know, in terms of whether qualified immunity is a protection that most people get, I think there's a really key distinction, and this is addressed in my note that Anya was talking about, but the expectation of the public, and in many cases, the law, at least for police officers, is that officers have a duty to act. And normal citizens and a normal, the general rule of tort liability that I assume our audience probably knows is that there's no liability for omissions. You can walk by the drowning man in the river and you can let him drown and you don't have to do anything about it. But a police officer who sees that something suspicious or dangerous is happening or has probable cause to arrest often has a duty to do something. And in some cases, the failure to act on that duty can lead to civil liability. There's 22 states that have mandatory arrest statutes for domestic violence crimes, and it can even lead to criminal liability. There's an officer in Baltimore, Maryland, who a couple of years ago was convicted of misconduct in office and criminally charged and convicted for failing to use enough force. He didn't use enough force on a suspect, and he faced criminal prosecution for that. So to the extent qualified immunity does basically give officers a little more breathing room in terms of this fair notice, you know, I would say that that reflects the law's expectation that, you know, comes through in the Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, at least, that police officers are supposed to be out there ferreting out crime and sort of proactively enforcing the law. Now, some people think that's bad. They don't think officers should be proactive about enforcing the law. They think officers should just answer 911 calls and otherwise sort of do the minimum amount of policing possible. But we do have, you know, a serious, in my opinion, a serious problem with crime in the United States. And so that kind of gets me to my point about the practical impact. I think it's a contradiction in terms to say that qualified immunity is too powerful and too burdensome for plaintiffs when the reality of the numbers that William is citing from Joanna Schwartz, who is a critic of qualified immunity, is that there's only immunity granted in about 4% of these cases and maybe about 10% of causes of action versus plaintiffs are getting settlements, according to her numbers, in 56% of these cases. 15% of these cases are getting dismissed as a sanction. And of the 7% of cases that go to trial, defendants are winning pretty much all of them. So what that tells me is that courts, and this is something I address in my note, courts are really not enforcing qualified immunity the way the Supreme Court says they should. What is the impact that has on officers on the street? Well, you know, there's a lot of talk about indemnification for officers who do get a judgment against them. There's a few problems with that argument. First, you know, there's something called Lexipol, which is a company that basically writes policies for police departments around the country. And so every time there's some change in a judicial decision, Lexipol actually incorporates these policies, and then they basically sell a policy manual that incorporates standards to officers. And also, you know, some cities are self-insured. Seattle's a self-insured city. Insurance companies, insurance risk pools, they demand certifications. They demand certain standards, right? Because they don't want to pay out this liability. And as a result, they're going to set policies that deter proactive policing. If you have judgments that are entered against you, even if the city ends up picking it up, the policymakers, either through, you know, the insurance companies in Lexipol or in self-insured cities, we had our own policy unit and our command staff, they're going to change the policy either formally or informally to deter officers from engaging in proactive policing. The other side of the coin is that being sued is not fun, even if you don't have to eventually pay the judgment. You have to be deposed. Your name's going to be in the news. And, you know, there's always the possibility in certain areas, you know, NYPD, the New York City routinely threatens to not indemnify officers, is my understanding of their policy. So when that threat is out there, what you have is just another reason to not go into policing when policing is a really tough job. And over the last 5 years, states that have taken qualified immunity out by amending state law, New Mexico and Colorado, have seen really major declines in police staffing. New Mexico is actually sending the National Guard out to do policing right now because they're so short-staffed. Colorado voters just passed a $300 million ballot measure to try and hire more police officers because they have so few. So turning back to the sort of the highlights of, in terms of the larger question, I think split second decision making is important for officers. I think the better framework to look at it is through a question of good faith, whether the officer's acting in good faith. And I think Villarreal versus City of Laredo in the Fifth Circuit is a good example of this, because in that case, the officers, arrested the plaintiff based on a statute that had never been ruled unconstitutional. They went to a prosecutor and got approval, and they got a warrant. So as a reasonable officer, I'm thinking, who else can I ask? The legislature, a judge, my prosecutor, they all say that this is a legal arrest. What else do I do? So I think in those kind of situations, even though there's deliberation, what you want to do is set out a pathway for people to say, how do I find out what I'm supposed to do and not do? Right? If I do have time to deliberate, how do I do the right thing? And if you're consulting, if you're asking for judicial approval to do something and you get it, I don't think a reasonable officer is going to think that what they're doing is illegal. You should be entitled to rely on a judge. And unfortunately, under current case law, that's not always the case. As far as, the common law origins of qualified immunity, there's some really good work out there by Judge Oldham, who wrote some work in the Journal of Harvard Law and Public Policy about the sort of common law qualified immunities that were available at the time of the founding under the Fourth Amendment, or the precursors to the Fourth Amendment. Scott Keller has also written a great piece about some of the common law support for qualified immunity. But I think if you really rewind things and you go back to 1870 and you ask the Congress that passed Section 1983 questions like, can a police officer shoot a fleeing felon in the back to apprehend them, right? Which we all know now violates Tennessee versus Garner since the 1980s. But in 1870s, Congress would have said, of course, we're not banning that, right? What's happened since Monroe versus Pape in the 1960s is you've had a gradual expansion of constitutional tort liability. Cases like Katz and Terry. There's a study that I cite in my note that talks about how only 13% of our Fourth Amendment jurisprudence is really originalist. So what you have the court doing under Section 1983 in practice, I would say, over the last 50 or 60 years is you've developed a set of common law constitutional torts. And of course, a common law set of constitutional tort defenses like qualified immunity. Is that problematic without Congress getting involved? I'll just say this. Since Pearson versus Ray was decided, Section 1983 has been amended twice. 1979, DC was added to Section 1983. And in 1996, there was amendments relating to judicial immunity. And in neither of those cases did Congress decide to strip qualified immunity out, even though it knew it was already the law. In 1976, Congress passed the Civil Rights Attorney Fee Award Act, which basically creates a new statute where plaintiffs' attorneys can get all of their fees paid for these lawsuits. And I think most importantly, in 1995, the Prison Litigation Reform Act is passed, and that act actually explicitly references a screening for immunity defenses, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense if the goal of that statute is to protect prison officials from lawsuits. That statute basically presumes that there is an immunity that exists. So I think there's a serious case to be made that qualified immunity is legitimate, both in terms of the court's development of a constitutional tort common law over the last 50 or 60 years. And I also think there's pretty good evidence at this point that Congress has fiddled around with the civil rights liability regime at great length and never seen fit to revisit Pearson versus Ray and the qualified immunity jurisprudence. So I don't know if I'm bumping up against my time on you, but I think I probably am. So I might leave it there.
Yeah, you did great. There's something that I've been thinking about as the two of you have been talking is this idea of, Pearson versus Ray has been mentioned several times. And Elliot, you talked about the good faith standard, right? That seems to me, for our listeners, and I'm sure a lot of you guys know this, Harlow versus Fitzgerald has this clearly established law standard, which does not concern itself with whether the officer acted in good faith at all. And Pearson versus Ray is an earlier decision by the Supreme Court from 1967, where good faith was a big element of deciding whether an immunity should be granted. So William, you first, and then Elliot too. Is that a potential point of agreement for you two in terms of if we were to look for a standard that is onerous on plaintiffs, less onerous on plaintiffs, but still provides protection to government defendants, is something that you could see yourself compromising on? William, you're muted.
Thank you. It's a good question. You know, because generally the Supreme Court has said we're not supposed to get into officers' heads when we're assessing use of force, because the Fourth Amendment is judged by a reasonable officer standard, right? It's not really about what were they thinking at the time. It's like, what would an officer in their position was reasonable do? And, you know, I'm not sure that good faith is a great fit, because, you know, the Fourth Amendment bars unreasonable searches and seizures, right? Not malicious ones, right? Or bad faith ones. It's about reasonableness. And so, and also I just think, I'm not sure that like good faith, bad faith really makes sense for officer decision-making. Like, I don't think officers who use excessive force with some exceptions, right? There are definitely some bad faith ones. Like, we had a case where an officer came in and wiped, you know, put feces into the mouth of an inmate who was bound and shackled. But like, I think most excessive force cases don't really break down along good faith, bad faith lines. You know, it's an officer who used way too much force that was vastly disproportionate to the threat, but I'm not sure he or she was acting in good faith or bad faith. I'm just not sure it sort of matches what's going on. I do think it's really interesting, Elliot, what you said about sort of officers having a duty to act, and so they should have sort of extra protections, right? Because they have more duties than the rest of us, or maybe they have more protections than the rest of us. That's interesting, because I get a lot of phone calls from potential clients who want to sue the police for what they didn't do, right? For not taking action, for not investigating, for not protecting them from whatever. And almost never can you sue the police for that, right? There's almost no civil liability, with some narrow exceptions, for when the police don't protect you, even though, you know, protect and serve is on the side of the police car. So I would be more okay with qualified immunity if we actually had a robust, civil liability for not doing the policing part of it. But I don't really see that in actual practice. So I don't know. I mean, I think I'm more open to tinkering with stuff, but I'm not sure good faith really captures what we're trying to stop, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think, you know, to Anya, to start with your question, I think good faith is in a lot of ways a better standard. And I think, you know, what Judge Oldham and Scott Keller have sort of discovered through their research is that historically there's a presumption of good faith, and the plaintiff would have to at least plead past that presumption of good faith. And there's also a similar sort of regime in immunity statutes like the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act. And that statute is a good analogy, I think, for why I think, you know, not having this standard is a problem. CAPTA is a statute that we recently had a case involving this. And, you know, basically to get around it, plaintiffs have to do enough pleading to show that a person who reported child abuse was acting in bad faith. That's, you know, not only consistent with the common law, but I think it goes back to what William was bringing up, which is it is really hard to have a constitutional tort lawsuit against officers for failure to act. Now, the Ninth Circuit has taken some creative approaches to that probably differ from what you see in the Fifth Circuit. But William is generally correct that, you know, you're not going to face as much Section 1983 liability for, you know, failing to act. On the other hand, you know, I hear William saying we want to collapse the analysis on the Fourth Amendment front into just generic reasonableness, right? And the practical effect of that is that you turn the Fourth Amendment into sort of a negligence liability for police officers. Well, you could have avoided using this force. You know, we can think of some ways you could have avoided using this force. So now you're going to be sued for, you know, Fourth Amendment violations. But if you had just done nothing, then you'd be off scot-free, right? You know, so whether or not there's liability, I think we as a society, you know, you want police to go out and do policing. And if you were to totally get rid of qualified immunity with constitutional tort law currently the way that it is, the practical effect of that is to really deter proactive policing, because no matter how unreasonable you are, if you sit and do nothing, you're not going to be sued. But if you don't have qualified immunity, you can be held liable even if the court goes back and totally changes the law. So, for example, Coniglia versus Strom that was decided a couple of years ago, that's a case where officers had a call about a potentially suicidal man. They ended up going into his house and taking his firearm away under the community caretaking exception. The First Circuit says that's good to go. There's a circuit split, but we think you're good to do that under the Fourth Amendment. Goes to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court says, no, the community caretaking standard doesn't go that far. I don't think those officers should be held liable for what is basically a retroactive change in the law in that situation. And if they are liable, and then you know that there's no liability if you just don't do anything, then you probably don't go try and get that gun. And, you know, there's the downsides of that too, right? That very rarely show up in this liability. The, you know, do I take this person's kids away from them? That's a huge, huge infringement on liberty. But of course, if there's child abuse happening, somebody could die. Do I arrest this driver for driving under the influence or let them go? If I let them go and they crash, there can be, you know, all kinds of heinous consequences that, because of what William is saying, never really show up in the constitutional tort litigation world. So I do think good faith is the best standard in terms of being grounded in the common law rule. And I also think it's the best approach from a practical perspective.
Yeah, I'll just jump in. I'll say, look, I think there's a lot of merit to that, right? Which is, look, it's not fair to sort of hold someone accountable when the court says what you did was illegal, and maybe that hadn't been said before. But if that's fair, that should be fair for all of us, right? Look, if I'm sued for attorney malpractice, and, you know, a court says what you did was malpractice, even though we haven't said that before, that doesn't seem fair to me, but I will be held accountable for that. I don't see why officers shouldn't be held to the same standard that you, me, Anya, everyone in this room is if we break the law. And I mean, just asking officers to follow the Constitution and not violate the Constitution, I don't think is that burdensome a request.
Well, I think that's a good point. But what I would say about that is, you know, as a private attorney, you and I are in private practice, we're in this to make money, right? At least to some degree. We're providing a service to our clients in exchange for money. We're part of a business. The business's goal is to be profitable. Public officials are acting, presumably, for the benefit of the public, right? And if you look at public officials who are practicing law, and this is one of my favorite things to point out, the immunities are actually much broader. As we all know, judges have absolute immunity from any liability. You know, no matter how crappy my warrant is, if you sign it, right, you're not going to get sued for that. Prosecutors have very close to absolute immunity. Sometimes there's some exceptions to that. And, you know, even other individual actors in the legal system, for example, you know, state bar, I think the Ninth Circuit recently held that our state bar has absolute immunity. So when you're talking about lawyers who are in public service, lawyers generally actually have much, much broader immunity than regular old public servants in law enforcement or other parts of the executive branch do. And, you know, I think that's sort of a key distinction. And another key distinction is something that really works to plaintiff's benefit in these cases, which is that you are getting all of your attorney's fees paid if you win. I mean, there's a case in Seattle that made the news a few years ago where an officer was sued, went through a whole trial. There was, I think, two of the three claims against him. The jury found no liability. One claim against him, they awarded $0 to the plaintiff. The judge converts that to $1 in damages and then tacks on six figures of attorney's fees. And by the time the whole thing is said and done, it's $1 million in attorney's fees out the window for a case that a jury said is worthless. So if we're talking about standards that apply to everybody, the tort liability standards that apply to people in, you know, the private world, generally speaking, the attorneys suing them are going to be working on a contingency fee arrangement. And so I think if we're going to say fair is fair, we'd have to go back to some sort of system like that. Congress didn't want to do that, but I question whether or not they would have passed the Civil Rights Attorneys Fee Award Act back in the 70s if there was no qualified immunity, right? They're looking at it saying, hey, you know, in light of the whole system of immunities and torts that we have, we think this is reasonable. But to take one out without taking the other out, I think really upsets the balance.
So that kind of all this discussion about duty to act, and Elliot, you also mentioned Villarreal versus City of Laredo, made me think back to Justice Story's opinion in the Apollon back in the olden days, where you had an officer acting in good faith, right? But there was still an injury to the plaintiff. And what Justice Story said is that the duty of the court is to decide whether the right was violated. Focus on that, not on duty, whether the right was violated. And if the right was violated, order a remedy. And it is the job of Congress to see whether the officer acted in good faith, whether he acted pursuant to the duty, and then indemnify or, you know, have a law that would specify things like that and kind of have the onus on the duty part with the political branches and the onus on the rights part with the courts. So what do you guys think about that? Because I feel like sometimes when we talk about qualified immunity, we kind of talk about rights and duties as one thing and we kind of don't separate them from each other. What do you think about just focusing on the rights violations when it comes to the judiciary and focusing on duty and good faith when it comes to the legislative branches?
Well, I think, sorry, I don't know, William, do you want to go first?
No, go ahead, Elliot.
I think that's tough to sort of say where that falls these days, because if I'm recalling the opinion correctly, or if I'm remembering when this was said, at that time, Congress sort of had to appropriate money for every judgment, right, that was entered against the United States. And that sort of gets into weird Article I issues, whether or not the judiciary can appropriate money without, you know, congressional approval. So I'm not really sure how far that gets these days. And I think, you know, as I mentioned previously, in terms of the section, you know, Section 1983 and what it was intended to do, you know, that's something where there's specifically a focus on state officials and enforcement of the constitutional rights against state officials. So, you know, and most states, again, they're not necessarily looking at, you know, the appropriation issue when they're deciding whether or not to indemnify an employee. So I think my concerns are a little more like at a systemic level, right? I don't know, William, I'll let you, curious what you think.
Yeah, and then something else I think what Anya was saying that made me think is, you know, we've been talking a lot back and forth about sort of qualified immunity from the officer's perspective, from the defendant's perspective, right? You know, what is it like to be a defendant in a lawsuit? What is it like to be sued? Do you have to pay a judgment, right? There's a flip side to that too, which is from the plaintiff's perspective, which is if you're a plaintiff who's been seriously hurt by the government and you sue, it's pretty hard to hear a court say, yes, your constitutional rights were violated. Maybe a jury said your constitutional rights were violated, but then you don't get paid. And because even though a judge or a jury, or maybe both a judge and a jury has said these officials broke the Constitution and hurt you, you don't get anything for it because we don't have some case law from other cases. So, you know, that's a hard pill to swallow. And I think kind of, you know, corrosive to the very idea of what does it mean to have a constitution that binds the government and prevents them from hurting us.
Well, I think on that point, you know, and it's a fair point. I think that's something the good faith standard can help solve. I know that you had a case I was reading about where some sheriff's deputies, I think you mentioned it, where some sheriff's deputies were told by their prosecutor, hey, what you're doing is probably unconstitutional. And then they went and did it anyway. Well, even in my world, you know, relatively defendant friendly world, I would probably say that gets past the good faith test that I would draw up, right? Because if you're going to go and do something that your prosecutor told you is unconstitutional, you're kind of doing it at your own risk. You know, in terms of the remedies that are available to plaintiffs, I think, as a practical matter, Joanna Schwartz's study, when she looked at over, I think, 1,100 of these cases, found exactly one case where a court said, your rights are violated, but I'm granting qualified immunity anyway, which tells me that those sort of circumstances are an extreme outlier. And then, of course, there's all the other remedies that are available, too. You know, and there's, of course, a preference. You know, everybody likes to get paid, but there is injunctive relief available, declaratory relief available. Qualified immunity doesn't apply to those. It doesn't apply to state claims. And so there's a whole universe of other relief available for a plaintiff in that situation. But I do agree, you know, in circumstances where an officer really is doing something that they know or sort of recklessly ignore the fact that they should know is illegal, I think this would solve a lot of the issues that come up in the clearly established context, like Jessup.
Yeah, I think one response to that is that, you know, we're talking about qualified immunity, right? And sort of a doctrine that protects police officers and immunity. But, you know, I'd be more okay with qualified immunity if it was sort of like the shield for officers, right? Or government officials, but it's not. It's like one out of a bunch of different shields, overlapping shields that they have. So in addition to qualified immunity, there's often sovereign immunity. And under state law, there's often state law immunities. In Louisiana, you can win a case against the government in state court. They don't have to pay you, right? And so there's all these other overlapping immunities. And Joanna Schwartz has actually found, she thinks the other shields are the stronger ones. Things like Monell are a bigger impediment to accountability and compensation than qualified immunity. So I'd be a lot happier with qualified immunity as it currently is, if it wasn't for the fact that it is like, I don't know, the outer or inner layer of armor, depending on what you're like thinking about, and lots of other layers. And I mean, it's not that rare that clients are told that, you know, Constitution was violated, but qualified immunity kicks in anyway. We had it happen 2 months ago at trial. A police officer came into my client's property, shot their 16-week-old puppy dead, even though the puppy was so small, it couldn't even bark. It was about this big. And the qualified immunity got put to the jury, which is confusing on its own. And the jury found that the constitutional right had been violated, but there was qualified immunity. And so explaining that to a client is pretty hard, and why that should be.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting you mentioned the state law immunities, because again, I think we probably live in a little bit different world being in California versus Louisiana in terms of how the states have chosen to address that. But, you know, one thing that Monroe versus Pape did when it sort of generated this explosion of civil rights liability in the 1960s is basically say, we're taking a very broad view of what counts as acting under color of state law. And there's some really strong arguments to be made that that was wrong. And if it is wrong, then the way that qualified immunity should work is as kind of a gap filler, right? Where if there is sort of a state law immunity for somebody's conduct, then maybe there's a cause of action under Section 1983, but otherwise there's not. And, you know, to the extent Monroe versus Pape was wrongly decided, and for all the reasons I've said about the layers that Congress has put on our civil rights litigation world, I'm not sure it makes sense to revisit at this point. But to the extent that's correct and qualified immunity is supposed to serve as a gap filler, it would have, you know, addressed those problems, right? Where if the state chooses to, you know, create immunities where there's no recovery for a constitutional violation, then there may be federal liability, right? With fee shifting and all the things that that comes with, or the state can afford a regular tort remedy that just looks like the regular tort remedy that applies to everybody else. So I think there's, you know, there's an argument to be made that there should be more of an interaction between the state tort immunities that exist and sort of the federal immunity scheme. But as a practical matter, you know, when we talk about laws like the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act that would have repealed qualified immunity, but only for cops, right? That's just going to cash out in enormous liability for states, localities, police departments without really changing or giving states an opportunity to change things by revisiting sort of their state tort schemes. So.
All right. I think it's about time that I ask questions from the audience. I want to clarify two things really quickly. So this discussion focused on state and local officials, and that's why you had a lot of discussion of how it is under, for example, California state tort law or Louisiana state tort law. We weren't talking about federal officials, and that's something that comes up a lot today with ICE raids and the like. That is a very different accountability bankruptcy regime at this point, because Section 1983 does not provide a cause of action against federal officials. So a lot of things like the attorney's fees provisions under 1988 don't apply here, or things like being able to sue an officer or a government official in state under state torts. You wouldn't be able to do that with federal officials. So that is something that should be a topic for another day, where we can talk about accountability specifically for federal officials. But that's something for the audience to remember. And also the injunctive and declaratory relief. Sometimes when we talk about Fourth Amendment violations and when you have like an excessive force type of a situation, the only remedy you can get under 1983 would be to sue for damages, because you can't show that the officer is likely to hurt you again. So those two clarifying things, let's turn to the audience. One of the questions was actually about charter schools. And William, you kind of mentioned it early on. And let's just talk a little bit more about the kind of standard that would apply to non-police in qualified immunity situations, and whether public school officials or maybe even charter school officials could take advantage of the doctrine, and whether it makes sense for that to kind of address the original question of whether it makes sense to kind of maybe provide more deference to somebody who is acting under, you know, split second type of a situation versus somebody like a public school official who has time, you know, and ability to think, at least when it comes to certain violations, especially, you know, for example, principals of schools or like board members, as the question here indicates. So either one of you wants to take on this kind of charter school liability point?
I think that's an interesting question. I mean, if I was a charter school board member and I'm sued under 1983, I, you know, if I was representing that client, I guess the question I would have would be, you know, should we even, you know, concede that we're a state official at all, right? Because if we can get out from saying, hey, we're a state official acting under the color of law, Section 1988 doesn't apply, I'm not looking at attorney's fees liability. So I think there might be a real doubt about whether or not that official qualifies as a state actor in the first place. And to the extent that they do, you know, I think a lot of the same concerns do apply for the same reasons that I've already stated. But, you know, of course, in terms of the deliberative conduct and, you know, my ideal world of the good faith standard, what I'd like to see is, you know, an official in that situation working for a school, whether it's a charter school or not, be given a clear path where they can go do their research. Where they can go do their research and come back with, you know, the best answer they can get, right? And if they're acting in good faith, be covered by qualified immunity in that circumstance.
William, over to you. And also, have you had experience of litigating in private prison context? That's something like, given your experience with, you know, prison litigation.
Yeah, only tangentially. You know, private prisons are obviously a big thing in America and a growing thing in America. So private prisons can be, under some circumstances, sued under 1983 because they act like government officials in many ways. And so they can, the case law, though, whether they can invoke qualified immunity is more complex. And frankly, I'm not sure where it landed most recently in the circuit. I think there was some back and forth on it. So, but private prisons, you know, are businesses, but they act like the government, and so sometimes can be sued like the government.
We have another interesting question here from Paul, and it kind of gets at this idea of qualified immunity at the motion to dismiss stage, right? Very often with qualified immunity, a lot of, you know, facts are alleged that to the best of the knowledge of the plaintiff, but there hasn't yet been discovery. And many circuits, and they're not consistent about this, but sometimes they would say like qualified immunity as a general matter shouldn't even be available at the, you know, motion to dismiss stage. So what do you think about kind of the role qualified immunity plays when it comes in before you even have an opportunity to kind of weigh facts?
Yeah. So, you know, it's tricky because we didn't really talk a lot in this hour about what are the practical effects of qualified immunity. Like when, you know, in a lawsuit, when someone says qualified immunity, what happens, right? At least in the Fifth Circuit, if the defendant invokes qualified immunity in a motion, like a motion to dismiss, all discovery has to stop. No more discovery until qualified immunity is ruled on. And once that motion to dismiss is decided, the defendant can immediately appeal to the Court of Appeals, even though most defendants don't get to do that. And sometimes you'll actually go back and forth. So like we have a case where prison indisputably held my client for months after his release date. But the case was delayed for years, waiting for ruling on a motion to dismiss. We couldn't do any discovery. They appealed to the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit decided mostly in our favor, came back down. We then did a little discovery, found out some other officials were involved. We added them to the case. Boom, another motion to dismiss. Qualified immunity again. No more discovery. Back up to the Fifth Circuit. So we're like 7 years into this case right now, and we're not even close to trial. So it's hard because, often you don't have access to the answers that you need to be able to precisely articulate exactly what was going on, and definitely not what was going on inside the officer's head if we're sort of looking at a good faith standard. But you have to be able to survive qualified immunity at a motion to dismiss. And so we think about qualified immunity when we're deciding whether to take a case, like what can we find through public records requests? What cases can we find that are closely analogous? And so, we turned down a lot of cases where I think that there's probably a strong chance of a constitutional violation, but we don't have a close enough case on point to have confidence about surviving qualified immunity. So we're thinking about it from when the client walks in the door, through trial and post-trial.
Yeah, and Elliot, you're talking about good faith, right? Some of that can actually be sussed out once you send out discovery requests or get a chance to depose an official. So how does that view that you have interplay with this idea of qualified immunity being available at the motion to dismiss?
Well, I don't have a super strong opinion about this one way or the other, because I recognize what William's saying in terms of it can be really hard to, suss out whether or not good faith existed without discovery. Washington State had a really expansive regime of public records, statutes. Not every state has that. So I see the point there. In terms of the practicalities, if you look at, I think, Joanna Schwartz's data, like I said, 15% of these cases are getting dismissed sua sponte or as a sanction. I think that tells you that there's probably a lot of lawsuits getting filed, maybe by pro se litigants who probably should never have filed this lawsuit. They're just not even getting past the 12B6 standard with or without qualified immunity. So I do have some concerns about just front loading, allowing sort of this wave of, lawsuits that really shouldn't be filed to get past the 12B6 standard. But if we were going to have a strong good faith standard, like the one that I've articulated, where you get a presumption of good faith and the plaintiff has to get past it, I think I could live with that being something that really only gets decided as summary judgment, especially because, the Ninth Circuit, the court has basically said, good luck getting qualified immunity at the 12B6 stage. And practically, I think Joanna Schwartz's data shows that's pretty much what happens anyway, right? The vast majority of these cases end up, at summary judgments where the qualified immunity gets granted, if it gets granted, in the cases where it gets granted. So I don't have a strong opinion one or the other. I think if there was a good faith standard that was enforced, then you could probably simplify things and just say it gets ruled on at the summary judgment standard.
I'm sort of thinking more about good faith as inapposite to the decision-making here, because I'll take this example of the officer who shot this puppy. His explanation, and I believe him, is that he believed subjectively that the puppy was going to jump into the air, fly through the air, and bite him in the penis. I don't think he was lying to me about that, right? But I think that's a crazy fear to have and was completely disconnected from reality. And so trying to use good faith to determine whether force was excessive or not, I think doesn't really connect to sort of the reality of things. We're really trying to figure out if the force was excessive, not, did the officer have some idiosyncratic belief that it was appropriate or not? I don't know. I just worry about good faith becoming the standard given what I see in reality.
I guess what I'd say about that is, courts routinely sort of infer subjective intent from objective actions, right? And so in that case, if you have body camera footage of what happened, which is now extremely common, I think it'd be pretty easy for the court at the summary judgment standard to look at that and say, you know, do I find this claim of good faith really credible in these circumstances? And if it's not, then maybe there's a dispute of fact, you get past Rule 56. I know we're pushing up against time here, Anya, so I'm sorry.
No, I just think it's interesting. And there are areas of agreement. It seems like we are identifying in some respect that this whole thing of does one size fit all topic that we got here to talk about, right? It really seems that both of you think that, you know, qualified immunity, really, it's not a bifurcated type of a situation where you should have like one particular standard for split second decision making and then everything else. It seems like both of you kind of talk about qualified immunity more as like a general standard of, you know, immunity for all the officials. And then the other interesting thing too is, you know, Elliot, you're talking about good faith as being a big element here, something that I think a lot of civil rights lawyers would be happy to also adopt as a standard versus the Harlow standard that exists today. So it is interesting that the discussion is, you know, has many different, it's not as black and white as a lot of people would assume.
Yeah, I mean, I think unfortunately, you know, the Harlow standard just isn't, it just isn't doing enough to actually protect against insubstantial litigation. So, you know, like I said, the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act has sort of a builds in this presumption of good faith, and a plaintiff has to overcome that. That seems to be pretty effective in that context. So if I was, you know, Congress and I'm writing from scratch, I think it'd be fair to say it's time to maybe revisit the Pearson standard. And I think there's good, you know, support for it historically, too.
I want us to really quickly address the two questions because I don't want to dismiss that. So one of the questions is specifically actually analogizing to the business judgment rule. And like, what do you think about thinking about split second decision making essentially as the judge saying, like, I'm just not even gonna be weighing in into this. And I think often that's how judges in practice feel. But that would get back to this idea of a bifurcated standard, which is, seems to me like neither one of you supports. And the other question is the whole codifying qualified immunity in the legislature. I know, Elliot, you're basically saying you think it already is kind of by implication, but like, what do each of you think about that? And with that, I think we'll wrap up and you can either answer one or both or neither, but go ahead. William.
I mean, I think the business judgment thing is descriptively accurate. You know, I think that's what's sort of animating judges and juries is not wanting to second guess, split second decision-making by officers. But I think we would have that sort of breathing room, whether or not we had qualified immunity. I think if we're just doing it under the Fourth Amendment, judges and juries will still be sort of affording that not wanting to Monday morning quarterback. So I think whether or not we have qualified immunity, that'll still be in our law. And then whether we codify it, I mean, look, I don't know why we should be making it harder to hold the government accountable when they violate our constitutional rights. It's already really hard. And I don't know why we'd make it harder. And then to answer one other question, yeah, I'd be happy to share the PowerPoint. Just shoot me an email.
Oh, yes, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, to start with the last question, I think qualified immunity is in many ways already codified, right? I think Congress has had chances to take it out of the statute when amending 1983. It has amended provisions relating to judicial immunity, decided not to get rid of qualified immunity. And of course, the Prison Litigation Reform Act explicitly refers to immunity defenses. In terms of the business judgment rule, I think that's just another good example of how it's not so black and white to say, well, the government's getting special rules that don't apply to other people. You know, we see similar things. I know, for example, under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, there's actually, at least in the Ninth Circuit, a qualified immunity kind of defense that a defendant can assert when, you know, whether or not the debt collector's conduct was illegal, wasn't clearly established, a defendant debt collector can sometimes raise that as a defense. So I think, you know, that's just another example of how what we're aiming for, you know, when courts are sort of crafting tort doctrines and Congress is writing statutes, is you're aiming to be fair, but also sort of promote socially beneficial outcomes. And, you know, to the extent that we want police to be proactive and crack down on crime, I think qualified immunity is something that's really important to have.
And with that, I am going to hand it back to Marco. And Mary, I feel like we addressed your good faith standard question kind of during the discussion. So in the interest of time, I'm passing it on to Marco.
Well, thank you all for that fantastic discussion and the benefit of your time and expertise today. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd also like to thank you, our audience, for joining us. We greatly appreciate your participation. For information on more upcoming events, please visit our website and all major social media platforms at FedSoc. On that note, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.